Chris Whittingham, Ira Winderman here on 560 WQAM. Here until 6 p.m. Coming up in the next segment, we'll be joined by Adam Beasley of the Miami Herald. Talks to Miami Dolphins after they introduced their assistant coaches to the media today. So we'll talk to Miami Dolphins coming up in the next segment. But I'm going to deliver on a tease, as I usually forget to do. But first, I got to tell you that Tucker Duke's Lunchbox is a Southern-style burger joint serving the best craft burgers, craft beers, and snacks in town with tons of flavor and just as much sass. Come visit their two convenient locations in Deerfield Beach and Boca Raton and learn why Tucker Duke's consistently wins awards for their amazing craft burgers. Check out their unique menu at TuckerDukes.com and follow them on Instagram at TuckerDukesDFB. Be caller 5 right now to win a $50 gift card to Tucker Duke's at 1-800-227-0560. That's 1-800-227-0560 to win a $50 gift card to Tucker Duke's in either Deerfield Beach or Boca Raton. So I said to you before the break, I offered you a prompt. You've had the commercial break to think about it. The Heat currently have a blank best player on a championship team. Who would you say is the Heat's best player going forward, and that player can be the blank best player on a championship team?
Well, actually, and we were also talking about whether it could lure another free agent.
Sure.
So whether we have, and there's two I keep waffling between. On one hand, I think it has to be Josh Richardson, or everything you've done to this point is flawed. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't believe it's Josh Richardson and you pulled him out, however it played out with Jimmy Butler, you've basically passed on other opportunities. But the player I think who has the most intrigue of being something special is Justice Winslow. I think he also has the most risk of failing of being someone special, because I think until, and I know the shot's been going in on the set shots, but I think the offense is still questionable enough in this league to be the guy you want someone to play alongside with. You have to be a 20-point scorer. And I'm not talking about a 20-point scorer 9 times this season like Justice is versus twice the rest of his career, but a nightly game-by-game almost 20-point average. And so when I look at Justice, I'm saying to myself, can this guy give you, with the ball in the right spots, 20 points a game, or is he always going to be more of a complimentary player? I think Josh can be more of the scorer. I saw that against Golden State. You could see when he's hot. I don't think Justice could ever get to a 37-point game. I don't think Justice has in his arsenal what gets you to a 30-point game. But there's something intriguing about Justice, and that's why it's going to be so intriguing come next week when the Heat come back. Goran Dragic is supposed to be back later this month. Basically, if the Heat wants to make the playoffs, has to be back sometimes later this month. And you and I spoke about this also on the air previously. What's Justice Winslow's ultimate position? And I've tried to get Eric Spoelstra to narrow this down, and he always has the out. I think you know what I'm going to say.
Positionless.
Yeah. Doesn't matter, Ira. Doesn't matter. You switch everything except with the five in the NBA anyway. Call him what you want. But, and you've seen this, and I've spoken to you about this. I was on the air as a guest last week, and I expressed concern about him and Deion playing together because who's going to have the ball? And you showed me in a two-man group, it's the best two-man unit or two-man wing that they have going, and I get all that. But you could also see in the game style, when Deion played really well, he, I don't want to say pounded the ball, but dominated the ball
that's
more
his game.
Against
yeah,
Dallas.
That's what he does.
Dribble, drive, probe a little, it takes it out of Justice's hands. Well, if you're going to bring Goran back into that mix also and make him a primary ball handler, I don't know what Justice's ultimate role is. I like this role. I think it's intriguing. I don't want to say like Magic Johnson or Ben Simmons, but we've seen bigs be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have yet to see opponents put smalls on them and pressure the ball. But if they do that, here's my question to you, Mr. Analytics. Does Justice have enough of a post game that if they do play pesky small on him, let's say America's favorite rat, J.J. Barea, to go back to the theme of our earlier show today about all-time Heat pests, does he, remember how we were talking about LeBron didn't take J.J. Barea into the post in the 2011 finals and we're all confounded? Does Justice have enough of that in his game? Has he shown you enough, Chris, where you could say to yourself, okay, you're going to play small and really make Justice be a point guard, he's going to punish you. We've seen Dwayne Wade do it over the years. I think you remember enough back in the day Tim Hardaway would do it. He was a terrific less than 6-foot post player because of his, well, let's face it, I like big butts, and I'm not going to lie. He was able to do that.
Yeah.
Do you think Justice can do that? Does he have enough of a post game to keep opposing defenses honest?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I haven't really studied that aspect of his game, nor have I really sort of dug in to the numbers on that. I'll look at them during the break.
Right. Numbers aren't great because his floater is still a little off,
sure.
And that's the next thing he has to get to also. That's why I'm asking Chris, because I'm not sure what he grows up to be. Again, he's only 22 years old.
Yep.
So there's still certainly growth time. I love the contract, $13 million a year for 3 years, third-year team option, so you really can figure out who he is. I think that's the guy. And I think that's why when you and I are talking about closing lineups, and Filero mentioned this also, where Justice is in at the end of the game all the time now, that's a good thing, and you have to learn. I think he's your future guy. That said, give me a lottery pick. Give me Reddish. Give me Barrett. Maybe even Morant. That could be the guy
higher
by 2020
ceiling.
Free
it's
agency.
It's a higher ceiling talent, right?
Yeah.
And I just don't. I mean, Justice Winslow is executing what he's being asked to do about as well as you can, and he really helps them win, almost to a surprising degree. I've been looking at his numbers, by the way. Basically, the dividing line for Justice Winslow is December 7th, when he really played his first game and really
Goran
took off.
Goran goes out,
against
he gets
Phoenix.
To play point.
Yeah,
right.
He had 28-6 against Phoenix that night on December the 7th. I've been kind of using that to really analyze him. Mm-hmm. So since then, Justice Winslow has only had 10 post-ups, 1 of 3 shooting, no assists, and 5 passes out of it and 2 turnovers. So almost nothing.
Middling, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even middling, nothing. I mean, 10 post-ups in 32 games and 989 minutes, 2,420 touches. This is all second spectrum data that the NBA has. That's almost nothing. But you look at the degree to which he helps them win. So in the 32 or 33 games since that's happened, Justice Winslow is a plus 11. And I was looking at the last 5 games since Kelly Olynyk became a starter. And that starting lineup, Winslow is a plus 24, Olynyk is a plus 18, and Hassan Whiteside is a plus 17 in the last 5 games since they made that lineup change. They're starting games better. They're starting third quarters
better. Yes.
And I think Justice Winslow has a lot to do with that. I've been someone last year, if you would ask
very
me.
Very skeptical.
I mean, I still am to some degree, right? I still think he's an NBA starter. He's a really helpful player. He helps you win. I don't think you build your team around Justice Winslow. I don't think you're saying you can't have another ball handler. Obviously, you can have a better ball handler than Deion Waiters.
Right.
But I don't think you're saying, well, we can't bring Goran Dragic back because it takes the ball out of Justice. I just don't think he's that kind of talent. We're saying you're building your team around Justice Winslow. What's the best case scenario of a team built around Justice Winslow? But obviously, he's made a huge step forward this year in some key areas. He's still defending really well in this mini 5-game period that we're talking about. They're 10 points better with him offensively, but they're 15 points per 100 possessions better defensively
and you can
as a defensive
and
player.
I got to tell you, it's an eye test kind of thing also.
Sure.
And he works it. He's not one of these guys where it's the BS the defense kind of thing and his guy just happened to miss a bunch of shots like Nowitzki, for example, did the other day wide open. Justice is working his man and playing both ends. Mm-hmm. But you're right. He's not an elite talent because he's not an elite athlete. He's just not. When I think of athleticism, I don't think of Justice. He has smaller hands. That's a problem also. He doesn't leap over you. That's the finishing issue also. Mm-hmm. So he might level off an upside at only a certain degree that other guys can pass also. That's why I waffled with Josh Richardson. Because I know Josh Richardson's more athletic and could do more. But I don't want to say he doesn't have the motor, because that's condescending, but he doesn't seem to have the it factor.
Sure. Right. I think, to me, it's like, if Justice Winslow has the ball at the end of a game and is dribbling the clock out, what does he do, right? Like, because to me, if you're building around a player, he's got the ball at the end, and he's making
right.
the decision.
He's not that player.
He's making the play.
He's not that player.
He's, for me, so technically sound and proficient. This might be hyperbole, but almost a LeBron James quality of always making the right decision. Whenever being presented with a situation, he knows exactly what to do, and is just such a cerebral and smart player in knowing what to do. But as you said, the it factor, it's an intangible for me that can be hard to lock down, right? It's just basically, if you're great, we give it to you. If you're not, we don't. But to me, it's more that final play of the game, final move of the game, what is he doing to create himself a shot? Can he create himself a shot?
No, and he's probably not the top 3 option on any player, and you even saw that at the end of the game against Golden State. The number one option was Josh Richardson coming off the double picks down low, got knocked off stride, tripped, whatever you want to say. The second option was was Deion coming up to the top and getting the ball. It was not a Justice Winslow play, nor would I expect it. Then I'd expect Dwayne Wade. Then I'd expect Kelly Olynyk or whoever else is on the floor before him. And that's a legitimate point because you have to be that guy, and especially when you get in playoffs and they know everything you're doing and you have to create out of it. He's not that guy yet. I don't think he can be that guy either.
So if you put Justice Winslow on Milwaukee, right? Milwaukee, best record in the Eastern Conference. They're a title contender, right? He would be, would you put him above or below the talent of Chris Middleton? Because
I put him below the talent of Chris Middleton.
Okay, Bledsoe?
Probably above Bledsoe, because I think he'd do more good things to help your other, because you have other good players.
Yep.
Because I think Justice can take care of Antetokounmpo, can take care of Middleton, so he would make good players better.
So you think he'd be the third best player on the Bucks?
I think he'd be the third best player on a potential championship contender. Yes, number three.
So that's his career, right? You think Justice Winslow is the third best player on a championship team?
Optimally, the third best player, yes.
But in actuality, probably more like four or five, right?
Yeah, but I don't want to go there.
I mean, it probably is more like four or five. Like, to me, the Heat don't have a player either now or in the future that could be the fourth best, best player on a championship team.
That sounds almost condescending because Draymond Green is the fourth best player on a championship team and has filled that role well. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a bunch of guys that Ginobili is the fourth best player on a championship team. Michael Cooper back in the day, you'd still need that, but you're right. That's how far the Heat are. So if by 2020 they're going to get their free agent, it's a terrible free agent class, by the way. Just awful. There's Anthony Davis and there's no one.
And Anthony Davis, basically. And that's the other thing that we've talked about a million times, is that NBA players now taking control of their future
1 to 2 years ahead of time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So realistically, the free agent class is not really a free agent class.
Right.
It's more like the trade class of 2019.
Right, to get
is basically what it's becoming now. And so maybe in 2020 they'll be ready to make a trade
for a 2021 free agent.
That's basically how you have to think of it now, right?
Yes. The world has changed because of Paul George's and Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving and everyone
in between. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, all these big moves are happening now via trade. So again, looking forward to a second half, but the future looks a bit bleak at the moment. Coming up next, though, we're talking to Miami Dolphins. Speaking of bleak futures, we'll get to the Miami Dolphins.
Nice segue.
And we'll be joined by Adam Beasley coming up next.
Radio.com. Radio.com.
Chris Whittingham, Ira Winderman here on 560 WQAM. Hockman and Crowder have the day off. They will be back on Tuesday. I believe I'll be here on Monday with Omar Kelly. So the full cadre of Sun Sentinel writers are joining me.
Dave Hyde was in today. I think he might be back next week. So yeah, we're taking over.
Yeah. One reporter at a time. Just need David Ferronis to come in here and sit in this chair next to us. All right. Getting ready to be joined here by Adam Beasley on the Toyota of Hollywood hotline. And he's kind of joining us here on the guest line. Adam Beasley, how are you, sir?
Gentlemen, what's going on?
Adam Beasley covers the Miami Dolphins for the Miami Herald and is on Twitter at Adam H. Beasley. So you had the opportunity today to speak to the Dolphins assistant coaches for the first time. Was there anything that was particularly revelatory to you, sir?
Well, I mean, I only got to talk to a handful of them because they were all at once and kind of split it up. So yeah. I focused on Patrick Graham.
One media relations official described it as speed dating.
It was an apt description. It was the Miami Dolphins version of media day, which was kind of cool because, you know, they have a brand new staff. I think there's only a handful of guys, Studesville, et cetera, Tony Oden, that are carryovers from the Adam Gase era. And so a lot of these people, not only had I never met before, but some of I had never heard of before the announcement a week and a half ago or whenever it was. So I had a chance to talk to Chad O'Shea at the Super Bowl, so I wanted to focus on the defensive side. And Patrick Graham's, you were there too, he was a pretty fascinating dude. I mean, he's Yale-educated, was going to study, chemical engineering, I think he told us, because he wanted to go into the CIA. And then he realized that science is hard, which I realized at age seven. So he switched to sociology and went into coaching. And what was the joke that we made? A wannabe spy signing with Bill Belichick as a match made in heaven.
Yes, yeah. Of all places to go to after wanting to enter the CIA, the New England Patriots organization, the next best thing.
So he will be the defensive play caller. There was some question whether or not it would be he or Flores. It's going to be him. And they're going to run a 3-4 and a 4-3. And that's, you and I kind of got into a little bit. That's easier said than done. Because on the defensive front, there are prototypes physically that you need to fill to make it work. You need big, strong guys to play at defensive end to take on those guards. How it's going to work with the personnel they have now is the question we'll kind of get into over the next 6 months. But I think the fact that when we talked to Patrick today, just reinforced to me, and I know about you, that this really is going to be Patriots South. From the GM to the head coach to the coordinators to the philosophy to the scheme, it is all Patriots. And other teams have tried that approach and failed catastrophically. I think the team with the most success has been Houston. Will it work here? Perhaps. But we all know that if they don't have a quarterback, nothing's going to work.
Now, for me, I guess the chief difference, and I found this all along between Brian Flores and a lot of the previous guys that have gone elsewhere, is that it does seem to be a bit more egoless, and that it's not exactly I'm coming down from the mountaintops with my genius and here's I'm going to spread it across the organization like Patricia and McDaniels and Charlie Weiss and some of these other guys that have come and gone. So, would you agree with that assessment? Do you find these guys to be a bit more down to earth and a bit more, you know, I'm willing to, you know, take on some learning, because for the most part, everyone's doing their job for the first time in their career.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think Chris Greer sets the tone with that. There's a reason that he has survived how many coaching changes and how many GM changes and how many ownership changes, right? Did he predate Ross? I don't have to look that up.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's been in the organization since like 2002. Yeah, so he would well predate Ross.
Yeah, so he's a survivor, and mm-hmm. I think you survive by A, being very good at your job, which he is, at least evaluating and drafting college talent, and B, not having that ego, not making waves. And I think one of the biggest frustrations he had over the course of all those different football czars they brought in was the dysfunction, was the coach and the GM weren't on the same page, they had different motivations, they had different timetables to win. And so when he had his first and maybe only chance to hire a head coach, he was going to find a guy cut from his mold and come up through that Parcells and Belichick coaching tree and not have that ego. And that's what Brian Flores is. So I think from a structural standpoint, they're doing things the right way, and they're doing things in a way that might be a little boring to fans. Certainly it's harder for us as reporters to get information out of them because they're not nearly as big a talkers as people have been here in the past. But that doesn't matter. All that matters is if they can get the most out of their players and win. And at the very least, I think players are going to acknowledge, hey, this is a different kind of tone here. This is professional. It's serious. It's drama-free. I mean, obviously, it's very early, but that's what they're trying to get to. And I think the more clutter you can remove, the better. Of course, it comes down to talent, and you have to have good players to win. But I think what Greer and Flores are determined to do is remove all that other crap from the equation. So if they have enough talent, it's going to show up.
Well, I'm curious about that, Adam, because if there were three major questions going to the offseason, we have the front office settled. We have the coaching staff settled. Ryan Tannehill, unsettled. And it seems like no one talks about or mentions the name until it goes away. We saw what Baltimore did. The Flacco issue is gone. The play, sort of everything is cleared up there. How is this going to play out? I understand there's certain salary cap time frames and things like all that, but is it still a dance where they have to pretend that it still might happen? And how is that being addressed?
Yeah, I think, was it O'Shea maybe? I wasn't there for him, but someone told me that he was asked about Ryan and just wouldn't go there. And which is understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to be gone. He's going to be either cut or traded. Everyone in the building and outside of the building knows that he has got whatever it is, 3 weeks, 4 weeks left as a member of Miami Dolphins. The question is, how can they facilitate that move? Are they able to get any kind of value from that? And in my opinion, the Flacco development was a positive one for the Dolphins. Mm-hmm. Certainly it took out one team from the equation. The Broncos are one of many teams that need a quarterback. But there's still enough options out there that they could find a trade partner, because when you look at Ryan's contract, and I think there's 2 years left, maybe $37 million, 18 and 19, one way or the other, and that sounds like, oh my God, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But the way NFL contracts work is when there's a trade, the team doing the trading takes on the rest of the salary cap hit for the signing bonus. So whoever, say they trade him to the Redskins, because the Redskins need a quarterback, mm-hmm. the Redskins would get Ryan Tannehill on a two-year, $37 million deal, which sounds a lot, but then when you think about it this way, none of those years are guaranteed. So after year one, if he stinks, it right. basically is just a one-year, $18 million contract with a second-year option. If he plays well, he'll be back for a second year. If not, there will be a team out there that needs a quarterback that has salary cap space that says, you know what, here's a sixth or seventh round pick just to make this happen. I think I'm actually a little bit more optimistic now after that Flacco move that someone mm-hmm. is going to be willing to part with a late draft pick. And again, if you're able to get that number off your books, sure. which is a big number, get some value for it, and then move on with your franchise, those are all good things.
And now, and we're joined here by Adam Beasley of the Miami Herald. To me, the quarterback situation this year, obviously there is a long-term plan that has been, for me, revealed by the owner of what they want to do. Now, we can discuss their route to it in a moment, but I just want to start for 2019. What would you say of these three is the most likely, I guess four, scenarios for what they can do with the quarterback? Number one, a rookie that they select in this draft. Two, a quarterback currently on the roster. Three, a veteran journeyman, a Ryan Fitzpatrick type, just to serve out this year. And four, taking a big swing on a quarterback that is available, a Nick Foles type. What would you say of those four is most likely?
Well, let's do it reverse but and figure it out by process of elimination.
Sure. Okay.
Number four is not going to happen. Okay?
Okay.
They because they've done that, and Ryan Tannehill is Nick Foles, is Ryan Fitzpatrick, is Joe Flacco, is Teddy Bridgewater. Those guys are all good enough to get you to seven wins, okay? And I know Nick Foles got hot in the playoffs, and so did Flacco, but it feels like a decade ago. But if, by and large, the market tells you what those guys are, and the market is those guys are going to be available because they're just not better than what there's on the roster, or teams are ready to move on, or so forth. So the Dolphins don't want to tread water. That's what number four would be. Number three, perhaps. But again, if you do that, you run the risk of being too good. I mean, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. They either need to be competitive and make a playoff run or be egregiously bad. Because if they're 6-7 wins again, this is a completely lost season. Completely. Mm-hmm. You have not made any progress. Unless, the only way a 6 or 7 win season is good is unless they take a, say, Kyler Murray or Drew Locke or Daniel Jones or you know, somebody else, a rookie that comes in on a depleted roster and is able to win some games. That would be encouraging. What I think they're going to do is this. I think they're going to draft a guy in, say, rounds 3-5, somewhere around there. They're going to roll with Fails. They're going to roll with Jake Rudock. They're going to roll with, wow. with the Washington State kid, Luke Falk. Mm-hmm. And one of those guys is going to win the starting job. And one of those guys is going to be good enough to go 3-13. And then they draft Tua. I think that's really what they want to do. This year, in my opinion, is this. Identify of your existing roster who can be part of a championship team. Two, go and rebuild the offensive and defensive lines. And three, be bad enough to draft a quarterback in the top five. Those are the priorities for this year. Unless, of course, they fall in love with Kyler Murray over the next month and a half. They draft him, and then all bets are off.
Is it even a given that Kyler Murray is going to be at their draft position? This reminds me so much of last year at this time. The Dolphins were talking about that Baker Mayfield would at least have a chance to be in their draft position. And then as, I think it was only 2 or 3 weeks out from the draft, and it's like, or he might go number one. I mean, right. I know Murray's a different body type, even though they're both small quarterbacks. He's as small, maybe, as I can recall in this league. So you have that working against
him. Him and Wilson.
But Russell Wilson had the frame to put on sure. more weight. Do you see a Kyler Murray possible Baker Mayfield type situation where if not number one or two or three, that he still could wind up out of the Dolphins range because it might not even be a trade-up possibility that he's a top five quarterback?
Yeah, Ira, it's a great question. Thing about quarterbacks in the draft is this. It just takes one.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes one team in the top 10 to say, this is my guy. And everybody else could have him as a second-round grade, but as long as that team in the top 10 has conviction in him, it doesn't matter. So I'm never going to predict where quarterbacks go. I think one would be a real stretch. I mean, think about it this way, guys. Kyler Murray basically has the body type of Bobby McCain. Okay? He has the body type of a slot cornerback. Could you imagine, you know, some of these beasts coming off the edge and depleting Bobby McCain, dropping back 25, 30 times, and then running, too? At some point, your body is going to break down. Physics takes over. So, yeah, that's why I think there will be a team that takes them in the first round, but it's not going to be as high as some people might think, just because you're putting – when you spend a top five pick on a quarterback, you're putting all your chips in the middle.
Right.
And, yes, Kyler Murray's got a ceiling as high as anybody in the draft this year, but his floor is much lower than I think a lot of guys out there for a number of reasons. One is size we talked about. Also, he's only started like 18 games or something, right?
Right.
I mean, he had this year at Oklahoma, and he had a cup of coffee with Texas A&M. What do we have in him? So he is one of the more fascinating draft prospects, draft grades I've seen in a while. And that's why I think mid to late first round would work. Are the Dolphins going to be that team? I don't know.
And that's the thing. I've always worried about a quarterback that your punter can beat up. That's always been a concern of mine also. So you have going.
I feel like the Hurricanes punter would definitely do a number on
the Australian rules football kicker. The other thing, Adam, I'm curious about is, especially because you're sort of in a role like me, you're writing sort of game stories on game days and things like that. Other people might be opining. I've always been trained that a win is good, a loss is bad. If you don't win, you're disappointed. So when you show up next season to write 16 game stories, you know what the backstory is. But honestly, what's it going to be like for you, for fans, and for people in the moment? Like, could you really believe that people will be celebrating losses? That when we listen to the 65-hour post-game shows on these two stations here, that people will be going a step in the right direction? Adam Beasley, what did you think about today's victory loss? I mean, what's the ride going to be like?
That's today's victory loss makes me laugh. That's good. I'm going to look at this year as probably Clark Spencer has looked at the Marlins for the last couple of years.
Okay.
And I'm not going to worry about the score. I'm going to worry about how the team was coached and what players you have developed and what players look like that can be part of your future. Because they're going to be bad this year. They're going to be very bad this year. And a vast majority of the players that are bad this year on this team are not going to be a part of the team in 3-4 years, when the team thinks they're ready to compete for championships. So for me, probably like Clark has done for a while, it's all about projecting, all about identifying who could be part of the solution long term. And, yeah, if they win a few games, that's fun. And I'm expecting the locker rooms to be rough, and I'm expecting, you know, fans to jump off the bandwagon very early if they ever get it on to begin with. But here's the thing, guys. And Ross alluded to this when we talked to him the day after the season ended. Insanity is doing the same thing over again and expecting different results. They have tried the Band-Aid approach, and it has not worked. I'm all for trying something different, okay? And if this is an epic failure, if in 2 years we're talking about a new head coach, new GM, because it just completely fell on their faces, they drafted the wrong quarterback, it didn't work, I'll say, you know what? At least they tried. At least they tried something different. Because from my seat, they are so far behind the two teams that played in Atlanta 2 weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
It's not even funny. You have to do something to close that gap, and you have to do something drastic. So, yeah, it's going to be lean. I will say this, guys. I wrote this yesterday for the Herald. Their season ticket base is kind of hanging tough. I mean, surprisingly, they've got 80% renewals, you know, with 9 months left or 7 months left to the start of the season. That's really good for a team that hasn't won a playoff game since, what, 2000, 2001, or whatever it was, 18 years now mm-hmm. It's been. So if nothing else, you have my undying admiration, Dolphins fans. Your resiliency is epic. I mean, it really is. The fact that you're able to hang tough and still want to go and consume a product that you know was going to be bad this year,
mm-hmm.
Really, my hat's off to you.
I guess my question, and it's always been lingering in the back of my mind as Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell are available, is, I mean, is there a way in which the Dolphins reverse course and decide that, you know, there's a move out there for them to make? Like, are you saying that definitively this is the route that the Dolphins will be taking this year?
Is Aaron Rodgers going to be traded?
Is today Friday?
Yeah. So, no. I mean, unless something absolutely crazy happens, like they get a Hall of Fame quarterback. No, because I still think that, look, Ryan Tannehill isn't great, but there are tons of quarterbacks in the league worse than him. And if they get a quarterback at the same level as Ryan Tannehill, how has this been a productive season? It just hasn't. So really, unless, and again, if you don't have a quarterback, nothing else matters. So unless you can get that guy who's going to be 40 touchdowns, 8 interceptions, 70% completion percentage, 4,500 yards, I mean, they don't grow on trees. You either have to get really lucky or draft a guy. And they haven't been lucky since I've been on the beat. They're going to try the latter.
But what about, because Chris and I have been having this debate on and off the air here about accidental wins. In other words, it seems it's also difficult to program to make sure that, okay, these are our lock 13 losses. We will lose these. You saw it this past season. I mean, I know you weren't as down on the Dolphins as Sports Illustrated and some of the Vegas books, but I mean, there was predictions of, what was it, 3-13 to start the year. Then they had the start to the schedule and it changed everyone's thinking for a month, but still. But I mean, couldn't you accidentally beat the Jets twice? Couldn't you accidentally beat Buffalo once? Couldn't you accidentally get your way to 6 wins? Because I think you'd agree, Adam, you have a young coach who's going to coach to win on game day. He is. He's going to try to call plays. If it's 2 minutes to go, he's going to try to win the game. He's not taking a knee in those situations. Isn't there a real risk of accidentally winning games?
Sure. But I guess my opinion is this. They've done that a lot the last couple of years. At some point, the luck's going to change. like last year, they had a 4 or 5 win roster at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And they won 7 games because Charles Clay dropped a pass.
Yes.
And what is it, Cody Parkey missed a kick?
Always, every year, yes.
And the Miami Miracle, that's 3 wins. That's 4-12 right there. And what's crazy is so many times, there's been so many turning points in the last 2-3 years where things could have gone poorly, which would have been better in the long term.
Right.
And here's an example I'll give you. Jay Cutler is a guy that probably should never have been a member of the Miami Dolphins. And if you put Truth Serum and Adam Gase and Chris Greer, they'll probably acknowledge that's correct. And that if they had to do it all over again, when Ryan went down in 2017 to start the season, they should have just tanked then. It's not in Adam's DNA, but they should have done it. Because that way they could have gotten a Josh Allen or a Sam Darnold or somebody like that.
Or a Josh Rosen, Baker Mayfield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And gotten their salary cap book in order. So you could be going into this season with $40, $50 million of salary cap space and Baker Mayfield, and this franchise looks completely different. So this team has been not only unlucky in wins and losses at the end of the season, it's been unlucky in how they've won games. Because 6-10 in 2017 was bad. 7-9 in 2018 was bad. Those were bad results, even though you say, 6 or 7 wins, that's not terrible, because it didn't improve them long-term. Thankfully, they're going to do it a different way. They're going to build from the bottom up. It's going to be a lot of pain, but at least you can see, you know, this isn't a Band-Aid. This is something long-term that we can build around. Let's go get the quarterback in 2020, and if it works out, we have a team that can compete for a championship year in, year out.
Adam Beasley, find him on Twitter at Adam H. Beasley. Read his coverage at MiamiHerald.com. Appreciate the time.
All right, guys.
Thanks,
right,
Adam.
That is Adam Beasley joining us here on 560 WQAM. Chris Whittingham, Ira Winderman here until 6. Radio.com.